Hi, this is Richard Taylor. Welcome to the second part of the design commentary for the Return of the King.
The Causeships was an opportunity for some of the members of the team who don't normally get in front of the camera to actually have their day in the sun.
And I must admit I had hysterics when I saw them all together.
Biker boys. Great stuff. The Hell's Angels of Middle Earth.
Exactly.
We'd sort of done it twice. We'd addressed the entire Weta workshop as the Corsairs, and we realised that having the opportunity to come back and do it again, we could do it better. So, and then it was completely recast, of course, except for adding in Peter and, you know, Richard.
It was really a terrific day. The opportunity to try and be a Corsair and pull grisly faces.
Look of horror was brought to you by Rick Porras.
It was funny because on the day of the shoot, I asked Tanya and our son Samuel to come along to set, and Sam ultimately got quite unsettled.
Very, very funny. Richard's little boy just did not want to know him. Dad did not look or sound like Dad, even though it was Richard's voice.
Poor little darling.
Now, this is a set piece that we built in the studio as we look into the cave of Shelob. And it was built in the same space as the Caverns Below Isengard from film one, and again is sharing much of the same rock pieces with a lot of alterations done to the surface of it.
John did drawings which showed a very particular look to the surface, which suggested that Shelob's acid had kind of leached into the surface and created this sort of white and eaten away look.
I've tried to imagine that Shelob's almost corrosive nature would have sculpted these shapes into the landscape just by the fact that she walks through these places all the time.
The thing about Shelob sets is that we made it in segments so that you could go around corners and see other corners beyond, you know, but they were all separate segments that you could move around. So there was no specific drawing of what the configuration was at any one time.
This gave Peter the ability to make these sequences of Frodo walking through the caves feel longer and more complex than what it actually was. So we were able to get a lot of different angles from a relatively modest sized series of set pieces.
Yeah, it's like building a haunted house really, isn't it, which might take up just a few square meters. When you're in it, yeah, every angle offers something new and mysterious.
Yeah, we're able to go to town with dressing things then, with the spider webs, obviously. But, you know, we kind of looked at spider references for the way that they wrapped up bodies, and obviously quoting what was going to be happening to Frodo ultimately. Then we're trying to find oversized dead birds and insects and all sorts of things that we could have to dress into these cobwebbed areas. Peter was very keen on a sort of a boneyard where Shelob's previous kills had been left to rot.
We had a friendly taxidermist, and some of them came from university as well, and we just hang up the animal and wrap them in the cobwebs. It was very effective and very spooky walking through the set.
Yeah, it was.
Really spooky.
Even without Shelob.
And the cobwebs, well, there's a story in itself.
The cobwebs are made from two polymers that you mix together. You have to heat them up to 220 degrees, but if they get to 228 degrees, they burst into fire. But if you don't get them to 220 degrees, they don't mix properly. And then you have a big vat of water, and you dribble it onto the water, it floats on the surface.
You'd sort of draw it onto the surface of water and then peel it off on a frame, and then those frames were delivered to the set, and then we'd carefully take those webs and then fasten them onto the rock.
We had a special room we built on the back of the studio so we could make the cobwebs on the spot, and we did have somebody in a rather distressed state coming in saying, the vat's on fire.
We're running out of fire extinguishers.
And we've run out of fire extinguishers. Where are the rest of them? So we were busy ringing the production office to see if they had any, and the runners were racing down with fire extinguishers, because you had to use a certain kind of fire extinguisher.
You had to use the CO2 fire extinguishers.
When we eventually decided that we should be calling the fire department, they came and they said, you did everything that we would have done. So we felt like we'd covered all our bases. It was a bit scary when you thought about it, because it was attached to the studio.
Yeah, no, we had a
practical Galadriel's file, didn't we?
Yeah.
And we had those blown by, I think those were made by the university glass blower.
And it had a little light inside.
Yes, but it had a little practical light.
But of course it was augmented by digital cast rays coming out of the file as well.
As you can imagine, it was great having a chance to design Shelob, one of the great antagonists in the world of Middle-earth, really the only female antagonist.
I think all these Shelob shots are fantastic.
There are some really ghastly moments in this, though, aren't there? Really terrifying.
Shelob went through a very interesting design phase. We felt very challenged by the Harry Potter spider. It had been so beautifully built by Nick Dudman and his crew over in the UK. And we wanted to make sure that our spider had significant differences so that it wasn't compared coming after the piece. Peter had always talked about her being very realistic, very much like a real spider, but not a single species of spider, a combination of all different sorts of spiders, to build ultimately a design that encapsulated everything that he feared through his arachnophobia of spiders.
It's great that you know, someone who's not terribly fond of spiders creates this really scary spider.
We needed to suspend Frodo on wires as though he was caught in all these webs. And so we had a series of webs made on frames, and we had a rock tunnel coming to a sort of a split. And then where that split was, we stacked up a series of these framed cobweb pieces, and then on the outside of that mounted the exterior part of the tunnel. So for each take that Frodo ran into these webs, we were able to then replace them with new ones for the second take and the third take.
Weta had designed Shelob years before this was filmed.
We had a design lock-off on Shelob, and we in fact even took it right through to scannable Marquette stage, and Weta Digital scanned it into the computer and started work on it. But wonderfully, Peter came to us in the third film pickups and said that he wanted the opportunity to revisit Shelob, which we were delighted to do because we never really felt that we cracked something truly grotesque.
So they went back into the design process and produced a malformed and really gritty object.
It was ultimately Ben Hawker, one of our sculptors, that cracked a look that Peter enjoyed. He described how he wanted this feeling that she'd had a stroke in one side of her face and her face was distorted. And there was also this sort of horrible mangy-like infection in her skin down one side of her face.
His tunnel web spiders caused Peter a great deal of concern when he was a child. So we tried to capture the look of that in the look of Shelob.
Do you remember when they were sculpting Shelob in the workshop and Steve Unwin was having to sculpt underneath her belly, and we were always a bit concerned from the health and safety aspect as to if we ever had a collapse of the sculpture that he'd get squished by the big Shelob sculpture.
So that set piece is about 2.5 feet above the studio floor, but the rest of that chasm was created digitally. And in that wide shot, the frame just occupies that small area around Frodo where he gets up and walks away, and the rest of it's a miniature.
It's always tricky with continuity on clothing. You can see the web jumps around a little bit, but it was so difficult to know shooting scenes months, if not a year ahead of actually shooting the scene of him within the cave getting caught up in the web, how much web to actually put on his clothing. And I was pleased to see that the scene played out incredibly well in respect to that continuity.
For Frodo and Sam's costumes, we took them to certain stages of breakdown, you know, from pristine to slightly broken down to further, you know, so on, right down. And I think there was kind of a point when really you didn't know where the hell it was going to go to. So you were sort of guessing. we would take it to a certain stage, and then as more information was revealed, as the filming continued, then you knew that you could go back into them and add X amount more, and then something would happen on set and we'd get a note back from Emma and Sian and the girls on set saying, we've done this at stage 3. So the ones that were in the workroom would be brought up to that breakdown point, and so on. So much work goes into the invisible elements in a film, which actually has involved many decisions about where a tear is going to be and what the backstory to that is, and, you know, and what, you know, will they've been through the mud there, so there'll be, you know, mud layers dried out and dusted off, and fire here, so now it's got soot smudges on it, and so on, and then to the point where you just go, these clothes should be barely holding together at this point. It can be a very therapeutic process, being in the aging, distressing department.
I'm not. I'm a hobbit.
We'd built Eowyn's helmet over a couple of months in the workshop, and she wore it for the whole of the original filming of film 3. But on her return for the pickups, she asked for a meeting with us, and we made adjustments to the helmet as she felt that her face was being too covered and she wasn't able to express her emotions from underneath all of that metal and armour. The problem with this was that we had set off with the philosophy that we wanted things to look real and look as though they would actually work in reality. They were proper military armour. And so finding the fine balance between keeping a performance working and not losing the reality was a bit difficult. But ultimately we found a middle ground. Needless to say, Miranda was very gracious about the whole process and all the trial fittings that had to go on.
The flaming boulders were basically straw.
The bound up straw that were thrown in there by the physical effects team.
Now that's one big battering ram, boy.
Gron was actually a very sizable miniature. The original idea of Gron being 100 feet long, so it was a 25 foot long miniature.
Tolkien describes it as being in the shape of a wolf's head, and I thought it would be a great idea to have a fire actually lit in the in thing's mouth.
Yeah, those flames in Gron's mouth were digitally added.
It had little ramparts along the top and smoking pyres on the very top of the ramparts. The black smoke is to disguise the orcs below from the archers up on the walls. And then the archers along the ramparts can fire back at the enemy.
And thus now will I sleep.
Brian Massey's a great craftsman at assembling found pieces of wood into trees. We bought this great assemblage of wooden pieces together to be remade into the White Tree of Gondor. That was made up out of pieces of wood from the backs of farms, from found pieces of driftwood and all that sort of stuff.
The tree does reflower. I mean, the flowering of the tree is one of the elements that heralds the end of the Third Age and the beginning of the Age of Men. I mean, it's interesting that this should coincide with the decline of all forms of magic in Middle-earth. You know, and it becomes a human world.
So this is a model shot of the...
It's the Hallows. Part of the Minister's miniature. And the Steward's Tomb.
Actually, it's one of the longest sets we made, and Brigitte and her team of sculptors sculpted a lot of reclining stone effigies of the stewards, and a lot of it, of course, has this burning sequence in it, so we had to flame proof a large part of the middle of it.
Bring wood and oil.
In the original description of Gron, it was a wolf-headed battering ram. Well, we wanted to take it a little bit further and make it feel as though the battering ram was actually a wolf that's being shackled inside this cage. And as the cave trolls swing it back and forwards, the idea is that it's leaping at the door, spitting fire out of its mouth with its eyes glowing, aggressively biting down on the wood. We built a breakaway door at quarter scale. It was a balsa wood and urethane construction. It had cast lead hinges that would rip and tear and bend out of the way. great working on the trolls again after building the troll for the Moria mines, and then the ones that we see at the Black Gates pushing the gates open in the second film. So to be able to revisit the trolls and build these huge mountain trolls that could go into battle at Pelennor was fantastic.
There was a false perspective set where you looked up the sort of reducing staircase to a little Grithungol tower at the end.
It was a one-to-one scale where Frodo pauses, and then it was a scaled-down version at the far end.
Very creepy. Peter doesn't really like spiders very much. At one point he said that even worse than seeing an actual spider was seeing it inside a crevice or a hole where it's only its feet are protruding out from where it's hiding. And that was one of the concepts I tried to do in a drawing that I'd done at one point.
It's one of those ones where you want to yell, behind you! Here she comes, watch out!
Oh, so brilliant.
It was a great design brief to design the stinger and the spinnerets around the stinger, because it's obviously an incredibly creepy appendage on this creature.
Now, we had a spit made for this sequence where we tied a Frodo double onto this turning device and had the webbing on a drum as well, which was able to unravel as we wound it around the double.
Let him go, you filth.
One of my favourite characters in the history of Middle-earth is Ungoliante, who is basically Shelob's grandmother, and was recruited by Melkor to kill the Two Trees of Valinor.
We did sculpt large sections of Shelob as practical animatronic sections, with every intention of using them on the film, but our Weta Digital once again proved the superiority of the digital involvement, and in fact we shot very little of those elements that we had built in the workshop.
You don't even want to touch it, do you? Even with your feet.
We built a little blue screen puppet section of the mouth of Shelob so that Sean could have something positive to kick against, as if he's kicking against the mandibles of Shelob.
These are really horrifying moments too in the film, aren't they? You're totally mesmerised by all this action and the imagery.
What I like in much of Tolkien is the sheer disproportion, you know, the physical odds in favour of many of the evil creatures in Middle-earth were just disproportionately so huge, which really underlines the power that's contained in the weapons that the hobbits and the other foes of Sauron use. And there's no way that Sam should survive an encounter like that, but there's something in the very nature of Sting that means that it's destined to do what Sam is able to do with it. So I think this inherent disproportion is a good way of underlining the forces that are at play.
There'd been a lot of inquiry on how we'd intended to do Shelob. There's a huge amount of interest in Shelob from the fans around the world. She's obviously always been a long-time favourite. I think because the spiders play such a big part in The Hobbit that people see the species of giant spider as characters that have carried over. So it was neat to finally see Shelob on screen and fulfil so many people's expectations.
I love the way that she squeezes herself down those tunnels. It's all right, he's not really dead.
He looks so much like, you know, that Valentino or something out of one of those really early films, that eye makeup.
He does.
Almost want to take him home, don't you?
Actually, no.
Don't go where I go, follow.
We didn't have a precise idea of the geography of Shelob's domain in the pre-production work. So it was more a question, rather than actually mapping out a labyrinth of tunnels, it was more a question of sort of trying to enhance the menacing nature of the landscape. You know, this is the great thing about Tolkien, is that every bit of geography reflects to some extent the nature of the actual place. But, you know, Shelob's lair shouldn't just be a bunch of damp tunnels. It should actually be an extension of her nature. I did quite a bit of drawings of the path to Cirith Ungol. The hobbits are hemmed in by these walls of sort of eroded rock full of holes. A lot of the coast around around Seatoun and Wellington is sandstone, and the action of the water and the salt and the tides and the wind etches out the rock into very very gothic shapes. And I love that kind of rock. I took hundreds and hundreds of photos in New Zealand while we were there. A lot of the time, just walking up and down the beach around Seatoun, and every time it was absolutely miserable, windy, wet weather, there would be two guys out on the beach, and it would be Alan and me, you know, with water running out of our hair and down our necks, and absolutely enchanted at being out in that weather. Just magnificent with the waves and the rocks and the wind and the, oh, it's great stuff.
This orc was a great character to create and played so wonderful by Stephen Urie, a terrific New Zealand actor. We wanted him to be quite perverted in his performance and the way he played this character.
So there was a small set piece that was built just for the shot of Pippin going down that little lane to the steward's tomb, and that was composited into a miniature shot.
The top of the dome didn't exist, actually. It only went up to a height, and then it was cut off for lighting, you know, so they've got somewhere to poke their lights through. Yeah, by and large, a lot of these studio sets were filmed inside non-purpose-built sound stages, so they were warehouses to all intents and purposes, and proportionally they often had fairly low roofs, which is always a problem for Andrew Lesney, of course. Brian Bansgrove, they never had enough room to get the lights back very well. You know, they're always having to really back their lights right up against the inside of the ceilings of the roofs. In the Steward's Tomb's case, the roof of our set was very close to the top of the roof of the building as well.
And this is an incomplete tower. I think we were meant to have a another couple of stories on that, but I don't think anyone would have missed it.
It's lovely seeing the Gondorian armour in this sort of firelight as it reflects off the steel plate. Savannah Green would coordinate all of the ingoings and outgoings of all of the armour and weapons, which was a huge job in its own right. And then Jamie Wilson would look after all of the crew on set that would be looking after the armour and weapons. Paul Van Omen and the miniatures crew did such a wonderful job dressing the miniature that we had delivered to them to look as though that the progressive damage was happening as the battle raged on.
This set here was part of the Helm's Deep set, which included the very top of the Helm's Deep tower.
Yeah, we added a dome to it and some other walls, and we also used what used to be the back stairs of Helm's Deep, which were cut into the rock face of the quarry that we were using, where Aragorn and Legolas retreated during the Battle of Helm's Deep. We used that same little gateway as part of the set as well.
That was the Force Perspective Tunnel.
We used a Force Perspective curved tunnel just to make it appear a little bit longer. You only get a little glimpse of it, but it was kind of, we were running out of space in terms of the quarried level that we were on, so we just kind of created a Force Perspective of that.
The Witch King was one of Sauron's lieutenants, and he was in command of the fortress at Angmar.
The helmet design for the Witch King was worked on very late in the piece. We'd actually created a helmet early on, but Peter was concerned that it was too close in its design to the helmet worn by Sauron, and some audiences may be confused by the two characters, and therefore we set about trying to design something that was dramatically different to Sauron's helmet. We wanted this sort of Ku Klux Klan type hood. It's got a parody of the crown of thorns that Jesus wore in the form of these horrible metallic spikes erupting out of the helmet, as if this character is almost an antichrist.
So this was filmed at Twizel. A lot more figures have been added into the shot, as well as the dawn sky.
Twizel was a great location to go and work at, on this massive field where we managed to put together this huge group of horse riders to ride the horses of Rohan. And we had such a great time with all of the Weta crew dressing all of these riders into their armour each day. We of course had all of the orcs as well. It was actually our largest days on set. I think on the biggest day we had 600 people in full prosthetics, armour or weapons.
We had teams of people repairing at night and, you know, rejuvenating the armour and the prosthetics, and then literally by 2 in the morning the first of the extras were starting to arrive to start to be dressed, and it was, you know, it seemed to be endless, didn't it?
It was so great to see that many people as well on their horses just having such a good time, you know.
We got as many horsemen we could find within a commutable area. They were farmers, they were pony clubs, they were anybody and everybody who could ride a horse well.
And they were really keen, weren't they? They would just ride their horses in from all over the countryside.
Yeah. They would basically camp at night with their animals, and they really had a fun time.
They did. There were some great stories from these days. I was dressing the armour onto the extras one morning, and this woman was having her armour put on, and I asked her, had she been on for the last few days? And she said to me, no, I've just hitchhiked a few miles down the road through the night, roped me a horse, broke it in, and then bareback rode it back to set. That's my favourite story from my time on the film, the dedication of these people.
This scene with Theoden riding along, hitting all the spears, was quite moving.
It was not until 2 years later that Bernard told me that he was inspired with the idea of riding along, hitting all of the spears, that had come from a visit to the workshop where he had seen all of the spears standing in rows, and this had given him the idea that this is how he could raise his troops to a higher level of emotion.
He loved that stuff. It was boy's own, you know. I mean, Bernard is very much a participant when it comes to boys' stuff. That's great.
After we finished dressing King Theoden and all the Rohan on this particular morning, when the charge was about to happen and Bernard Hill was rousing the troops with this incredible speech, I was sitting back up on the hill looking down on this incredible vista, and I don't think my heart has ever been filled with such an emotional feeling as it did on that day, seeing all of the work that we and all the other departments had done laid out in front of us, and with this great actor playing such a wonderful role in the form of King Theoden.
Yeah, so most of these shots have got extra digital horsemen added in the background. And they work amazingly well.
That's the wonderful advantage of computers, is you can have horses go down in, you know, in a way you couldn't do 20 years ago.
The other great thing is that the digital element can turn 250 horses into 2,500 perhaps.
The incredible visceral feel of the Rohan riding into the ranks of the orcs, it just feels, it's so amazing, like a huge bulldozer just ploughing down these troops. And you couldn't help but fear for the lives of the riders, but they were so focused on making this feel as real as possible that they charged those horses again and again at full gallop across the plains and into the stunties who were playing the orcs opposing the charge.
So, Grant, what was that he poured over?
It's thickened as glycerine with water to give it a consistency of oil.
You really want to be jumping in the shower pretty quickly after that. That it looked great, you know, it does look like what it is. It took us about 4 weeks to build that set because it's just so many curves and compound curves.
Like most of the sets that we built, we made a little maquette out of polystyrene just to work out where all the various pieces would go. and to give Peter an opportunity to have his input and to line up any shots that he had in mind.
You may triumph in the field of battle for a day.
It's good to see Denethor in his mail shirt. It is definitely underneath his robes. They realize he's been wearing a coat of black mail, so I imagine it's a form of penitence.
Where did a Faramir dummy, didn't they?
We built a silicon replica of Faramir to lie on the burning pyre. And it was interesting because we heard back from set the day that the dummy was down there that one of the other actors had made a cup of coffee and brought it over to David Wenham, who they thought had fallen asleep over on the side of the set, only to discover that it was actually the silicon replica. I thought that was a great tribute to Jason Doherty and Gino and the team that ultimately built the puppet. It was incredibly realistic.
You know, they use really low temperature flames in film work, but it still generates a lot of heat. And we had to put these fire blankets over the top of the set to stop any damage to the building itself. They're very heavily plastered with this fire retardant foam for a start, and then fire retardant resin, resinous plaster, I should say, put on the outside of it, and really caked on.
For the principal photography, there had been a barrel rig built for a lot of the shots where actors are riding on the back of horses.
We put together this 44-gallon drum on springs and a frame with a piece of steel on the end of that for a head.
But Pete realised that for the pickups he would be better suited with something a little bit more sophisticated. So he gave us the job of building this realistic looking horse rig with an articulated head and neck. So when it arrived on set on the first day, it affectionately got named the Phony Pony. Needless to say, of course, in true Peter Jackson fashion, he immediately jumped onto the back of it and proceeded to ride it in front of the whole crew, which got a great deal of good laughs.
The Mummikill.
I loved working on the Mummikill to get to design these amazing war creatures, these huge beasts that would carry the Haradrim into the battle. We went through quite a major design phase, firstly through illustration and then through sculpture, building the Scannibal Marquette and seeing all the different tusk formations that you could come up with to individualise the creatures, and then ultimately seeing how Weta Digital armoured them off Christian Rivers' art direction was so wonderful.
I think at some point Peter came to a decision about how many Mummikills he wanted. And basically wanted, enough to
turn the tide of battle, really, isn't it?
To make it feel that the Rohirrim have a really formidable task ahead of them.
Trying to design the war platform up on the back of the Mummikill was quite tricky, and we ultimately came up with the idea of almost an upside down teepee, this structure that could be lowered onto the backs of these creatures, strapped on with a belly strap, and then it would open up and form these huge fabric parapets.
Yeah, we had it built on a sort of a gimbal with these bungee cables to hold it up.
And then we had it on these big truck springs mounted on the ground so you could rock it. And with 20 people up there, you could get it rocking quite nicely, yeah.
So it's quite a difficult piece of engineering.
It was very safe, entirely.
It had a metal frame and then was clad with lots of bamboo and then lashed together, because the Haradrim, had a slightly exotic appearance.
When we were designing the Haradrim, we wanted them to have a certain influence from the Pacific Islands, and so we tried to invest a level of Papua New Guinean and Pacific Island influence into their armour and weapons.
It's great that the guy hanging off the Mummikill's ear is enough to turn it in a circle.
And they're almost like something out of a George Lucas film, like spaceships, aren't they, when they go out of control and go off to the side. Now, you couldn't have done this 5 years ago, just not possible.
Pete often will brainstorm with us various ideas, but occasionally he comes up with some really extreme ones, and one of those was an idea that even for us was a little bit too crazy. He came up with the idea that the Mummical could suck the Rohan soldiers up off the backs of their horses with their trunks and then fire them out like bullets across the battlefield. And I don't know if he was playing with us or not, but we certainly were worried there for a while. The art department built the cage on the back of the Mummical to use for all of the shots of it collapsing and live action with the actors on it. We then got the opportunity to build a life-size version of the Mummical as a dead creature on the ground. And you can see it in the background in some of these shots. It was constructed out of steel, then with a polystyrene skin, and then we sprayed urethane on the top of it, and then finally hard coat, throwing a light sand covering into the hard coat. We had to build it very, very quickly. If I remember, we only had 21 days to achieve it, so there was no great ability to put in a level of detail. But everyone threw their energies into it, and ultimately we were able to deliver it. It took a large number of house removal trucks to get it to location.
When they took it out there too, they had to use a crane, didn't they, to put it together. And it was like doing a giant 3D jigsaw, just these great big pieces of Mummical being put together.
Yeah, and we'd have to organise the crane driver. And not only did we have to just lift it from beside the set onto the set, it had to be lifted.
The elements were so heavy that you couldn't just lift them up and drive them onto the set. You had to lift them and drop them and then go reposition the crane and lift them again and drop them.
But also putting it together, it didn't just slot together. You had to join it with foam and carve it and paint it and then stick the arrows in and put the saddle on. And it was really quite a long process.
We got very good at it.
We did.
The first time I saw it, I went out to look at the set. And the interior of the Mummical was hollow. And the crew who were out there had actually set up a TV, and they were watching a rugby final inside the dead Mummical. So I sat and watched the rest of it with them, and then we went out and carried on dressing the field.
That summer, we decided to have the Weta Christmas barbecue out there, and we took all the digital and the workshop families and had this fantastic barbecue outside in the big park where the dead Mummical was, and all the kids got to climb on it. And
yeah, we had our crew photographs on front of it. Everyone and their families climbed on top of it, and in that photograph you can't see any elephant. There were so many people.
Must have been really weird, actually, if you'd been flying anywhere near that film set, because there was a little airport out there. It would have been such a surreal thing to have looked out of the aeroplane window and seen this big, giant, dead Mummical lying on the ground. Very weird. They have a flying school out there too, and so you can just imagine these people trying to learn to fly, and immediately they look out the window and see this giant elephant below them with this Mummical. It would have been very off-putting.
No horses were injured during the making of this scene.
The art department manufactured a lot of the discarded battlefield weaponry. We had additions of arrows and swords and all that sort of thing were made to a fairly kind of moderate degree of finish for scattering around the place.
The desperate moment King Theoden has fallen, and now she has to valiantly stand up against this horrific creature. But the scene of her hacking the head off this massive creature, we thought at first it was going to be difficult to sell because her sword, and she is so tiny against this huge circumference of this neck. But the way Pete's cut it together, it's completely convincing. We'd built a mace for the Witch King to carry in this battle. We were worried that we'd made something ridiculously too large, and we showed it to Peter on set, and he said to us, "Oh, it's nowhere near big enough." So we went away and we built this Morning Star, this mace end that was just unfeasibly large. And we thought, "Oh God, we're going to be laughed off set." So I actually snuck it onto set, hidden underneath my jacket, so that people wouldn't rib me about it on the way to see Pete. And I showed it to him, and he goes, "Ah, perfect, that's absolutely perfect." It was made in a soft urethane, so if it actually hit the actress. It wouldn't injure her in any way. It's interesting to note that we actually only ever built one ship, and you can see here how Weta Digital have successfully composited the same ship again and again to give the impression of a whole fleet. The Minas Tirith docks, this is the last miniature that we built for the film. This had been on the cards for us to build for many, many years and kept being put off. And then finally we were asked if we could build it. We built it 3 weeks before the final cut of the film was delivered to New Line. So we had 5 days to put this miniature together. It's built at 35th scale out of urethane, cardboard and any amount of materials.
This is a great iconic moment really from the book and the film, when Eowyn reveals herself as a woman and therefore capable of killing the Witch King.
Sort of a Shakespearean moment.
Yeah, very much so.
The day that Miranda did that, I think she must have, her throat must have been so sore. She spent the entire day yelling.
You can hear her from the outside.
She was fantastic.
We had no idea how Weta Digital was going to play out the death scene of the Witch King, and when we finally saw what they had come up with on screen, it was so wonderful.
When it came to the corpses, Weta had a whole stockpile of them.
Yeah, so even the corpses are recycled.
We had a truck every day on set called the Gore Truck, specifically there to supply all the gore and the guts for the battle scenes, but it's quite interesting the way Pete's cut, it doesn't look as gruesome as we were expecting.
Weta Workshop had specific people on set doing nothing but putting the blood and injury effects around the battlefields and on the different characters. We had hundreds of arrow rigs and different decapitation and leg chopping rigs, different scars and injuries, blood pumping rigs.
Different recipes of blood and gore and guts, didn't we?
For the different species, different that's culture. Right. But ultimately, being the rating that it is, a lot of it can't be seen. But it's all archived away somewhere, so that one day maybe Pete will do an R18 cut of the film.
The Legolas attacking the Mullachal sequence was all conceived by Pete.
This is a moment of pure Peter Jackson filmmaking skill. You can imagine having this described to you and questioning how any director could pull this off with a level of reality that wouldn't destroy the scene at this moment.
It's quite a guy, Orlando Bloom, isn't he?
Yeah. Also, he was actually climbing up over a part of sacks rather than the back of an elephant.
We made the back of the elephant's leg using sandbags, and then we painted
from
them
the
grey.
Climber.
And he climbed up them. We'd built a sort of a set thing and it wasn't right, so Peter said it would look more real if we just used sandbags.
The sequence was storyboarded before we even approached making anything for it. How does he get from the ground up onto the back of the Mullachal, shoot it in this brain and then get back down to the ground again? It's this great concept, you know.
3 arrows into the back of the cranium, excellent. A bit of a brain tap there.
Yeah. This is a very popular scene with all the teenage girls. They love seeing Orlando.
So many of these orcs that are very time-consuming applications still put in on the off chance that we're going to see them for a fleeting moment. We were so thankful that Peter was happy for us to do that level of work every day, so that if there was a chance that a character was seen, we'd know that it was going to hold up and be able to articulate at a level that was necessary to get the shot.
This scene was shot out at Queen Elizabeth Park, and we had to dig a hole for
for Bernard
because the horse, the real horse, did lie. Oh, was that the false horse?
Well, it's eventually it was the false horse that we put on top of him. But he had to look as though he was half under the horse.
He was probably grumpy afterwards, but he was fine at the time.
he was good. He was good about it.
When you're in the midst of these sorts of things, you have to do your jobs, calmly, one by one, and to the best that you can do. And I like to think we set standards for ourselves back in the early days that we had to maintain. And, you know, it was very tough at times because these sorts of projects can be characterized something like pushing a boulder up a hill. You know, you're pushing it up and up and up and up all the way through pre-production, and then
you can't see the hill for the boulder.
Sure. And then when you start filming, it starts gathering its own momentum, and you can't control this thing because you have to kind of just run with it. And there's those times when you thought there's like a locomotive breathing down your back. You know, it's so this machine of doing the movie was so big and so unstoppable that you just had to deliver day after day after day after day. So you tend to kind of focus on the job at hand, and you don't often get the opportunity to stand back and kind of look at it as a movie, particularly as a trilogy, you know. So again, it's one of the pleasures of seeing it, you know, as the final film in a trilogy. You get to sort of sit back and look at it in completely new light. There was containers full of dead horses. Well, there were scenery dead horses that we'd made.
That department did a great job on all the dead horses. And it's funny, when you walk into the storeroom now, where all the props are stored, you can still see all these dead horses up on shelves and things. It's a little bit of a strange
thing. It was funny too, watching the art department carry them onto set every day and then pick them off set. They were these lightweight fiberglass horses with flocking on the surface of them. They look so real, so incredibly real, and they'd be walking in with them.
We had to do lots of running repairs on the dead horses. Because they
legs broke off
and ears broke off, and their legs bent out the wrong way.
Each shot, each frame, is art directed by the art directors on set for composition and things like that. You know, with obviously with Peter's day to day, moment to moment input with his requests, but you've got to consider that every single shot has got its own sort of compositional thing going on.
And it seemed to work out that there'd be time to actually make changes. Peter would run through a scene with the actors, and then they would go and get themselves prepared, and there'd just be a very brief window of opportunity to finish the dressing and line up things for that particular shot. Yeah, it would usually be a matter of just kind of dressing stuff to eye, and then Peter would come along and say, no, that's good, but can you add more?
More.
Now we're in the Houses of Healing.
Oh, great.
Oh,
Houses of Healing.
I love this one. I'm so glad it's in, because there weren't very many soft, gentle scenes like this in interior sets.
We wanted to make it feel slightly monastic, so the design of the Houses of Healing had it had cloisters, and it felt like the interior of a secluded little monastery.
Chainmail is a very interesting material. It has an amazing way that when it's dropped onto the body, it hugs to the shape of the body because its intrinsic weight pulls it tight. And when Miranda put on her chainmail for the first time, it looked so beautiful as it fell down across her body and sort of hugged her form. She asked if we could build her an evening gown out of it.
Houses of Healing are really a significant episode in the book, so it's great to see them in the movie. And they're such a quintessential part of the whole psychological healing of Faramir and Eowyn, where they come to terms with their lives and their encounter, and actually the epilogue that suggests, which is one that's, you know, full of hope and full of life and full of good things in dark times. So it's wonderful to actually see it in the movie now.
You can see the full-size dead Mummikill here quite well, one that we built out of urethane and steel.
Weta built it originally, and we shot it out at Queen Elizabeth Park.
And then we had the luxury of 3 weeks to put it together.
Dress it.
And then we did it for pickups overnight. And had
overnight for the pickups. So we'd be shooting on Pelennor Fields the day before, and then when they wrap for the night, we'd bring our props team in and a crane, and we'd crane the 5 huge pieces in and join them all together and put the saddle on and then dress it all overnight. So by 7 the next morning, it was ready to shoot. But then, at the end of the shooting day, we'd crane it all out again because we'd have to have a clean field for the next morning.
Kirathungal. This was a miniature that was designed by John Howe and captured the sort of quite geometric architecture of John's original designs.
Tolkien's description of Kirathungal was a fairly conventional one. Now it's 4 courtyards superimposed on each other with a tower, and that's not necessarily very exciting visually. So we tried to do something a little more novel. So rather than placing it into the mountains as you would a normal fortress, we placed it out on a huge pinnacle of rock that's jutting out over Mordor. You know, all the time never contradicting really what's in the book, trying to make it a little more exciting visually. So it was lots of fun. I mean, I really enjoyed the idea of having a lot of the doors in the corners of the structure, which is probably not architecturally a logical thing to do, but it gave it a fairly novel look, I think, for the movie.
This was a little 360-degree set with breakaway walls that we're able to tear away to get the camera in there.
The whole thing was really designed to be a stunt director's paradise. You know, we just built lots of opportunities for bodies to crash through flimsy roofs and steps for people to roll down.
Yeah, the configuration of the set only in part matched the model. It was kind of like, an amalgamation of pieces that were joined together that individual little dramatic scenes would happen in, but as a complex, it's one of our biggest sets that we've built.
I love the feeling that these orcs and Uruk-hai have allowed themselves to fall into rack and ruin. There's no great amount of discipline, and they just are all filthy and dirty and basically falling apart as troops.
Originally, Kirathungal was built as a watchtower by the Gondorians to look over the plains of Mordor. But, of course, many, many years ago, it had been lost to the Gondorians, and the orcs had taken it over and added on to their own orcish detailing. So it's an amalgamation of 2 different cultures here.
The 2 statues that are flanking the doorway into Kirathungal are actually from quite a significant sequence in the books. These 2 statues are actually stone watchdogs of a sort, and in the book they sound the alarm when Sam crosses through the gates into Mordor. There's a Maori influence in those sculptures. Absolutely. I bought tons of books on Maori stuff.
You get the feeling from watching this that he's moving through quite a big environment, but it was really a very contained little set. When we first made a maquette for it, it was budgeted and found to be about twice as expensive as the budget would allow, so we had to trim it down considerably.
That's straight out of the book where the orcs see Sam's shadow and think some great, great warrior is coming at them. It's a lovely little reference to the book.
It was a dirty environment to work in. It was always dusty, and you know, we threw a lot of sand and fine dust over things, and lots of oxides, dust oxides. So you get a lot of various colours.
Some lovely shots of the miniature here with Sam composited into it.
It was a John Howe concept to begin with.
Yeah, John had designed these wonderful little doorways and gateways in corners at angles, and we incorporated a lot of that into the final set.
You know, the whole idea was to actually try and give this notion that a lot of this architecture was designed at one point to keep Sauron in Mordor and not designed to keep everyone else out. So these are fortresses whose eyes are actually turned inwards to the land of Mordor in order to guard against Sauron coming out of Mordor. And then, of course, they've been transformed by their current owner into fortresses for a very different purpose. But once again, it doesn't necessarily add anything strictly to the narrative when you're watching the film, but I truly believe that it can enhance the depth and the credibility of the actual environment.
Well-polished ring.
Hmm.
And we never had it stolen.
Now, that was the one thing we sort of identified as being vulnerable, you know. It's small, it's valuable, and everyone would want one. But it just didn't attract that sort of attention. It was great.
And it was in a lunchbox that had on the front screws or something, and inside it was seven rings or thereabouts. Different sizes. It's funny, the things that people loved the most were like a personal hand prop of, say, worm tongue, like that handkerchief and that little vial thing.
Oh, the poison vial.
Everybody just loved that, you know. Beautifully made as well.
You must understand.
We would have pretty much all the props made in-house, but apart from some specialist stuff which we'd have to send out to jewellers or we had a lot of glass re-annealed to make it look more antique. Yeah, I think generally speaking that kind of reinforces the stylistic flavour of the film in a way. The fact that every single thing was made because everything was able to be designed with cultural perspectives and the dramatic requirements that the story needed. So, you know, we were able to sort of invest our original design in everything in the movie, not having to adapt it to something that's already existing.
We did it.
I love these two helmets, a little bit over the top, but this is straight out of one of Alan Lee's drawings. Peter was quite happy for us to do something that maybe could be considered to be a little bit more labyrinth-like or a little bit more extreme, but it was a neat opportunity to play up to one of Alan's wonderful pictures. You've got to hide them but not lose their ability to show their facial expressions through the armour and through the helmets. These were great fun. I like the feeling that that Elijah's wearing a helmet that could have been worn by an orc with a huge nose and his little face is hidden inside.
The statues that line the side of the main hall, we actually didn't end up with enough statues to fill up all the archway, so we ended up having to move them around shot to shot, so those observant people might be able to kind of see where we moved them to, but I think we had about sort of 80% of the holes were covered.
If we had to chop the budget, Peter would say, well, I'm not going to see that, so chop that off.
Because, yeah, that was always a consideration, was that even though we built vast sets, you say, well, say we've got $60,000 to do these doors, and you'd have to say, well, it's going to cost $120,000, so what do? Well, we'll cut this, I'll only look this way, and so we'll cut that bit off. And I won't look above this high, or if I do, we can blend in a piece of model to match that, therefore only build to this height, you know, so... In each case, we'd start off with the ideal situation, which is the whole set, and then we'd start chopping bits off it and get down to... If we needed to. We cannot achieve victory
through strength of arms. Not from all of these costumes were done completely from scratch. So if I decided that this was now going to be the opportunity to get this wonderful embroidery concept happening, it would be a case of fabulously calm people, which was who I was, with great senses of humour and preferably a background in caring for the mentally handicapped.
I think he will.
I regret that the Dunedain weren't able to be brought in some way into the movie. That would have been very exciting. The Dunedain are Aragorn's companions. They're the Rangers of the North who are Aragorn's followers, and they actually fight quite significant battles to the north of the Shire before they rejoin the Gondorian troops for the main battle. So there's a lot going on. There's an awful lot happening in the book that there's a tendency to kind of skim over because you're too intent to follow the main storylines. that's the density of these novels, is there are so many stories in the wings that, you know, it would be tempting to bring more of them in, but, you know, you can't put it all in. Oh, that's good. That's very skillfully done, isn't it? I was quite missing the fact that Aragorn takes up the Palantir to reveal himself to Sauron. He does it earlier in the book. That's worthwhile putting in the film. Really sets the stage to march out of Minas Tirith. The White Tree is quite a sinister heraldry, if you like. It's a funeral march out of the city. And this is where the black and white livery of Gondor, you know, really comes to the foreground, I think. Even though the White Tree is a growing living thing, the White Tree is now dead. And the symbol of the White Tree is, you know, once again a symbol of decline and loss of grandeur and hope. And the sophistication of the designs, you know, just reinforce that. So I find it quite moving. I find these grand banners and all of these surcoats and liveries to be very much like funeral garb. It does give a much grimmer background to this expedition that's basically doomed. You know, these may be, for all the protagonists know, the very last days of Minas Tirith and the Kingdom of Gondor.
Of course, once again, for the Hobbit's armour, we had to build all of this at two different scales, because Elijah and Sean are wearing the larger scale armour that matches their bodies, the larger scale helmets and weapons. But then when the Hobbits interact with the orcs later on in the scene, we had to also build it at a smaller scale so that the scale doubles could wear it again. And it was quite a mind flip trying to get around the scaling issues. The idea was that the hobbits were already wearing large scale helmets, because they have to give the impression that they were once worn by orcs who were even bigger again than hobbits. We shot these scenes up on Ruapehu, a volcanic mountain.
It needed very little work from us, really. And of course, in wintertime it snows up there, so it's the summertime version of a ski field, in fact, that we're shooting on here.
Because we're up on location, of course, the production wanted to get as much of the footage for the films done as possible. So we're doing shots from the prologue of film one at the same time that we're doing shots from the final battle of film three. It made for a real difficult continuity issue, but a great deal of fun as we tried to put the whole thing together.
Everyone's memory had a different sort of solution to the problems we found, you know, as we're going through doing particularly pickups 3 years later.
Tolkien never got as far as actually explaining agriculture and urbanism in Mordor. What do all these orcs eat, and where do they all come from, and all of those things that, you know, we don't necessarily need to know. Some design work was done at one point trying to suggest the habitations of Mordor, some of the buildings, the tents, the encampments, and I think there was not really enough time in the film to indulge in that kind of extravagance of detail, but there just seemed to be no point in actually trying to go beyond what Tolkien suggests, and we all have this tendency to wish to fill in logical gaps, but, you know, is there a point?
Phil Greaves is a great actor from mostly a theatre background in Wellington, and we had a good time putting these grossly deformed prosthetics onto him. The idea is that leprosy has infected his face and eaten away the end of his nose, and he thoroughly enjoyed getting into that character. These were huge days. We needed a huge number of dressers on set.
It was very tricky because it was up the side of a mountain, and even though it was sort of summerish, it was pretty cold. You know, we'd be up there very early and very late.
Just keeping the extras from not getting too cold was a big job in its own right, because during the action sequences they'd start to sweat, and then when cutters yelled they immediately begin to cool down again, never mind maintenancing the rubber prosthetics and armour. all of the background characters were wearing slip-on rubber masks, and so between takes we had to remove their helmets and then remove the rubber masks. There used to be this cry called out by the first ADs of heads off, which meant that the wet techs would run into the throng of actors and very quickly try and get their heads off so they could get as much air in before we went for the next take. We had about a break even level of 6 takes before the poor extras would actually be overwhelmed by the heat and their own breath inside the masks.
Was this the Sea of Boulders? There was an
area where
there's just a huge field of these boulders which have been left there by some volcanic activity.
It's just that, you know, you can see the sort of terrain they're walking over. Everything's a struggle, you know, and everything has to get up there and everything has to, but you have to take every step carefully.
And I remember there was a stream that we had to drive through. So it was almost pure sulfuric acid.
That's right. I mean,
and a truck had been stuck there once, and it just kind of was eaten away by the acid.
Yeah, I mean, it's a site of an active volcano, so it has all that sort of danger to it.
In an attempt to protect the fauna and flora around the areas we were filming, the production dutifully laid down huge areas of domestic house carpet.
Yards and yards, truckloads of carpet down for people to walk over.
To protect all of the little flowers and such like underneath the feet of the technicians and actors.
The white moss was a protected species. Because it gets covered in snow each year and obviously gets crushed by that, that wasn't a problem. It's just kicking the roots out of the ground was the real problem.
It looked hilarious if you stood back and looked down on the scene and this huge area of volcanic rubble and mountainside would be beautifully carpeted, just as if you could put your couch and TV and watch and settle down for a night at home.
And there was a huge commitment from us, particularly in terms of the Greens Department, to restore the location to its original state, which is a piece of national park with a lot of very delicate mosses and plants on it as well. It actually took a year's work for our Greens Department and the Department of Conservation to restore this again.
We're at a different part of the Ruapehu National Park, aren't we?
Yes, we're actually on army land here.
This was the live firing range.
As part of the New Zealand Army, and they kindly cleared the area of dangerous objects.
And so on the first day we had to have a course by the military in what to do if we found live grenades, bombs, shells and such.
But every so often someone would say, I'm here, I found one, you know. The army guys would come rushing over and check it out.
And when the art department were putting the spears in, they had to be really, really careful.
We'd be driving these metal standards feet into the ground with sledgehammers, and every blow you'd be on edge on the fact that you might hit a detonation shell and end up blowing your feet off. But the week passed without incident, and considering that we had hundreds of people on any one day on this live firing zone, it went very, very well. It was on this location that we used the army most heavily to play all of the Orc and Rohan and Gondorian extras.
This whole nature of the landscape in Mordor was really quite important to me. I wanted to imagine that the plains of Mordor would not just be, you know, a dusty expanse strewn with rocks. I wanted to imagine that it would be almost like as if you had a, you know, a terrible storm at sea with waves 30, 40 feet high. And if you could just suddenly freeze that and turn it into stone, and that would be the landscape of Mordor, a landscape that's incredibly hostile and frozen in that way, in shapes and forms that normally rock cannot really assume. You know, it should feel like passing into another world.
During winter, Ruapehu becomes heavily snow-covered, and we're fighting the elements every day. on a particularly blustery night. The snow was coming down very heavily, and sure enough, when we arrived at work the next morning, these are rugby field sized tents that are supposed to withstand incredible climatic changes had collapsed under the weight of the snow, and all of our armour and weapons on their racks were underneath these tons of snow and canvas. So everyone had to haul into it to dig out the stuff we'd need for the day's filming.
The Black Gates, designed by John, and again a very satisfying miniature.
I tried to get some kind of an idea across that Sauron would be yearning for Numenorean architecture taken to a new height, taken to the nth degree beyond Numenor. And I think that Sauron's attempts at this are a mockery of a style of architecture that's gone before. He wants it to be higher and grander and more imposing, and it's all wrong. It hasn't got the life in it. It's the opposite of life, and it's something I really tried to get across.
Yes, the mouth of Sauron.
I mean, what's interesting in Tolkien's text is that the mouth of Sauron is mounted on a creature that they think is a horse. You know, they're not quite sure. You know, it looked like a horse, but what was it really, you know? I love things like that.
Master Sauron the Great bids thee welcome.
Ugly mouth. Eating licorice.
That's pretty creepy, eh? That's very Peter Jackson.
Bruce Spence, what an amazing guy to meet. Of course, made famous as the gyrocopter pilot out of Mad Max. So when we knew that Pete had cast him to play the mouth of Sauron, the emissary of Sauron, how thrilled we were. And our idea with the mouth was that he had spoken so much evil that the evil has now split the skin around his lips. There's incantations of black speech etched into the metal around his mouth, and the idea being that this further enhances the evil that he speaks.
Peter wanted him to look a little bit more interesting than he did when he was shot, so the mouth was actually digitally enlarged.
Weta Digital very expertly blew the mouth up 15 to 20% to make it fill the whole of the mask that little bit more. We wanted the feeling that the actor was completely blind within the helmet, or couldn't see because the helmet sealed his vision. But of course the actor still needed to be able to be seen, hence the slits in the helmet. Sadly, you don't see a great deal of the horse here, but the mouth of Sauron's horse had a comprehensive amount of grisly armour across it as well. The decapitation we did as a physical rig, where we used a silicon dummy of the mouth of Sauron, and then Weta Digital very expertly painted it onto the head of the character.
I think the red eye is a difficult concept to actually make a graphic representation of, because it's a luminous, you know, light. It's a very bright, bright symbol. So how do you actually treat that in paint on canvas? I really don't know. I mean, at one point, I think I filled up edges of a lot of other drawings with little red eyes. And, you know, these are all just ideas that are thrown out by everybody involved. There were thousands of red eyes designed by everybody in the workshop. And I think the red eye is a recognizable symbol. And no matter how it's treated graphically, whether it's very sophisticated or very crude, it's still a recognizable version of that one basic symbol. And much less sophisticated, obviously, than Gondorian heraldry and Rohan.
We did addition of banners for the various different marks of Rohan, and of course the Gondorians have banners as well, so there's quite a collection of them there, all made by the drapes department and the art department.
We've got two brothers that work for us at Weta, Tim Tozer and Greg Tozer, and it was cool on these days because Tim had been tasked the job of looking after the Gondorian armour, and Greg had been tasked with the job of looking after the Rohan armour. So the two of them head to head trying to get these huge armies into line as these two brothers. Need to say, by some bizarre coincidence, both of them look corresponding to the armies that they're looking after. So it made for a great deal of amusement on set. All the wetter dresses are ducked down behind the back of these troops so that they could dive in whenever cut was yelled to help the actors with their armour and such like. So we're actually there hearing Vigo yelling his speech to the soldiers, and it was incredibly rousing and emotional. It really felt like you were at the edge of this huge war.
There's little smoke pots hidden amongst the rocks to create those steaming vents.
They were little tins with incense pellets that you light, and they give off quite a lot of smoke, and you can add glycerine onto it to bulk up the smoke.
Rufay was a great location. I remember going up there and seeing these orcs two by two getting into the ski lift to go down to the lunch place.
It's amazing how quickly you just get used to seeing bizarre images. You'd see orcs riding on ski lifts, you'd see orcs riding on the back of motorbikes, orcs sitting around having lunch together. Very, very bizarre sights, but you quickly accept it as the norm in life when you make something like this.
It's always tough to achieve a different treatment for each major culture. I mean, in a film like this where they have to be visibly part of the same universe, but also clearly distinct from one another. You know, on all that time remaining coherent and part of the same world, it's an interesting process to get involved in.
You would try and follow through each culture's decorative styles and heraldic styles through, so elvish and dwarvish and hobbit, etc., etc., have had its own kind of small props designed and made.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, you are working within the, you know, confines of whatever the civilization or the nature of the style of the character. But you can't help yourself. You're always looking to expand beyond the borders of it.
You know, a lot of fantasy films seem to have these diametrically opposed cultures where everything sets them apart. And it's a confrontation of worlds, whereas Middle-earth houses all these different races and creatures, and although they are opposing each other, they have to be kin of some kind. And you know, orcs weren't always orcs. I mean, all this is thinking of is intellectualizing on a very instinctive approach that doesn't necessarily involve a lot of conscious thought, but it's easy to sort of theorize after the fact. But I think that no culture is ever immune to outside influences, even to the influences that it doesn't necessarily accept as consciously as part of its culture. So yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
We produce thousands of drawings for these films.
Yes, Jackie Allen, one of our art department assistants, has had almost a full-time job since the end of the movie, just cataloguing and wrangling this massive amount of drawings and designs and drafted pages.
Then let us be rid of it.
This is my favourite moment from all three films, this little scene. Sean Astin at his best here.
But I can't carry you! Come on!
This moment here is everything that Tolkien wrote about, that without the camaraderie of friends, without the relationships built across different races of peoples, as in the relationship between Gimli and Legolas, all is lost. Without that unity, the lands of Middle-earth, just like the lands of our own world, will pass out from us. And this moment, this tiny scene, encapsulates everything that Tolkien has tried to say to us as readers, and Peter Jackson has tried to say to us as viewers. We as an audience know that Frodo and Sam still have a chance, that all is not lost, but we also know that Aragorn and Gandalf and the other characters around them believe that all is lost, believe that that there is no chance
for Frodo.
And for Aragorn, and then the hobbits, and all of their friends to take this moment into their hands and charge to their deaths is incredibly powerful.
What a guy. My hero.
Samoth Now was a delightful little miniature that we built for this particular scene. It's got this unusual architecture that's been built into the side of the mountain to designate the door into the Crack of Doom.
The doors of Samoth Now were a John Howe design. I remember his drawing was so big that it went off the top of the page, so he added another page on the top, and he went off the top of that one as well, so he had a third one on the top of that again. It just grew and grew and grew.
With the amount of work that had gone into Middle-earth up to that point, Samoth Now, just a doorway into Mount Doom where Sauron originally forged the ring, could not simply be a little hole in the mountainside like a copper mine. It had to be something much more complex and evolved. So it was enormous fun to echo the style of Barad-dûr in the actual architecture around the door and inside the Crack of Doom.
This is the rubber rock set. We basically filled the whole studio with this rock that started at ground level and went up to the grid at 45 degrees. And that was the rubber rock for the rolling and fighting.
There was great debate over many, many years how to conclude the battle at the Black Gates. The idea was originally that Aragorn would actually fight against Sauron. But as Peter and Fran and Philippa continued to write the script, they realised that that couldn't be the way it could play out.
Sauron no longer has a physical presence at this point in the novels, and he cannot emerge from his tower. I mean, his tower is his body. You know, the tower is the embodiment of whatever it is of Sauron that actually remains in Middle-earth. And I thought that to bring him back out in physical form would just be, you know, a major concession.
And ultimately they concluded it where Aragorn is fighting a huge troll. And as everyone will agree today, it was ultimately the best way to play it out.
It's the moss again, leading the way in for the eagles.
Well, the moss design goes right way back to the choice of insect that we've had to come up with that was going to be alive at the particular time of year that we were filming Gandalf on the top of Orthanc.
Like the protagonists in the movie, I'd totally forgotten about the eagles. And when that first eagle appeared, I nearly fell off my seat. It was so fantastic. Fabulous animation. They must have studied a lot of footage of eagles.
This is a forced perspective set piece, and as it looked back towards the doors of Samoth Now, they are reducing scale, going back to the entranceway. And there's only a very small amount of scenery other than that, because it's such a massive environment that it really only existed as miniatures and computer graphic work.
The miniature of the Crack of Doom was a particularly difficult miniature to build. It was a very intangible concept from the beginning. John Howe did a series of drawings for us, and we built it as a miniature.
There was a lot of discussion about how Sauron actually forged this ring and how much of his infernal machinery would still be scattered around in this set. And Peter at one point asked for a real river of lava to be flowing slowly past underneath the promontory where Frodo is, rather than just having a pit of, you know, bubbling orange stuff.
Basically, it's like a huge flume hole inside a volcano where shoots of lava have been feeding over centuries, and sort of like stalagmites have solidified and formed these fingers around this huge basin. The ceiling is hundreds of meters above our heads, and these huge fluted architectural shapes and walkways encompass this cavern.
I love the lighting of Frodo. Elijah is so dramatic in this scene. The
ring is mine. Why couldn't just drop it then? I don't know.
You just want him to drop it, Tom.
I do.
We did do Elijah in a transformation prosthetic that's ultimately not in the film.
There's a magic element to the forging of the ring itself.
The idea was that Sauron, you would hold out his hand and the piece of solid gold that he held in the palm of his hand would actually melt into his palm with the intense heat that was coming up from below. And without obviously frying his hand at the same time. And then he would, with his knife, cut into the palm of his hand, and his blood would mix with the gold. And then he would form the ring from there.
The troll that fights Viggo here was brought up very late in the piece, as Peter realized that he wanted Viggo to fight a troll as opposed to Sauron, but it was a great opportunity to put a final troll into the film and develop some new interesting armor for the character. How do you make Gollum ride on the back of invisible Frodo without it looking too silly? This particular scene was one that we talked about a great deal in early production meetings, but I think ultimately it's been pulled off in an incredibly skilled way. The stump here that we see on the end of Elijah's finger is just a prosthetic. Elijah's got his finger bent back out of shot, and then we've prosthetically applied a stump. It was very expertly done by Marjorie Hamlin on set each day. Elijah loves that sort of stuff, and he sort of embraced it as a cool thing to have for a little while. Every time I see Gollum today, it still fills me with such a feeling of pride that, you know, after being given the brief all those years ago, that firstly the design department, then Andy on set, and the whole of the crew that shot Andy's performance, the motion capture team, and then finally Weta Digital, and the direction of the character could bring such a rich and complex performer to the screen. To have played just a tiny part in Gollum's creation has been such a wonderful opportunity, and it really does make me very thrilled to see his role in the end on these films.
I do love the creme brulee with the ring on it.
But I remember they had a lot of trouble trying to get the ring just to sit on top of the lava and then gradually melt into it, you know.
So we built a ledge that he was able to be suspended off by a wire a couple of feet off the studio floor, and for Sam to be able to lean over and pull him back up.
And so this is nearly it for the ring.
Take my hand!
And for Frodo.
Once again, you know, the sequences surrounding this were shot at such different times, you know. I mean, this stuff was shot right at the beginning from memory, and then the stuff we've just seen was shot right at the end. So it's sort of 3 or 4 years in between.
It's so much more dramatic that this ring is so cold that the aura that surrounds it would resist the intense heat of the only place it can ultimately melt it.
Things start to go badly for Sauron.
Out of here.
Oh,
yes.
We toiled for years over how to ultimately take on the destruction of Barad-dûr and the Black Gates of Mordor.
I did a series of Photoshop studies in which I showed Barad-dûr collapsing and Mordor being destroyed and the Black Gates being destroyed all in one long shot, which would last about half a minute or so. And people liked that idea, and we did quite a lot of work on it. But in the end, it was felt that it would be better to actually cut it into segments and intercut it with reactions of the principals.
Grey Hushfield has talked to us for many years about his desire to take on the destruction of Barad-dûr. And it was so wonderful for Peter to embrace the talents of this incredible CG artist. Grey has been with us for many, many years and has solved some of the trickier problems that we've faced at a digital level. So it's so terrific that he got to do such a masterpiece with this destruction.
That's great, that sort of nuclear power wave.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
considering how late in the final year of delivery Weta Digital ultimately got the turnover of these shots and got the chance to do the destruction of the Black Gates of Mordor. It's incredible how beautiful and realistic and epic these moments are. Look at this for a moment in the film as Mount Doom is erupting.
The idea that the Nazgul would be destroyed was there right from the beginning, and I know that John was very keen to see them burning up like moths in this huge, great, fiery inferno.
A huge amount of research and development was done on the lava, firstly by the guys at Weta and then on by a special lava department headed by Chuck Schumann and Scott Harens. I do think that they ultimately did some incredible work with the lava.
Now, much of the lava was shot on a specially constructed tilt table.
It's the biggest piece of engineering that Weta's ever built to allow for the flow of lava across the rocky surfaces of Mount Doom. The lava was made out of all array of components initially, but we ultimately settled on methyl cellulose as the primary ingredients with various fluorescing powders and pellets and such like.
It was encrusted with bits of cork and other stuff to give it that kind of cracked lava look. And then the table would be tilted and the whole thing would flow down and would separate and kind of break up in a way that looked fairly convincing.
So this is methyl cellulose flowing down a translucent underlit table with urethane rocks placed in amongst it. But at scale here on screen, it looks suitably large. But a lot of research and a lot of development went into ultimately getting these moments on screen. The lava bombs are a combination of techniques, but primarily little charcoal briquettes that you put in a fire to help with a barbecue or something like that, just thrown down across black fabric and hitting the ground with shards of sparks. I think they were turning over 100 shots a week at the end. Some incredible level of work.
That rock that they've escaped to was built as a set piece. And, in fact, I think that was down in the little tennis court.
It was, yeah. It was built, just the top part of it was built. And it was another one of these opportunities to take it down to Queenstown as a weather cover set. And so, it also survived a year being locked away in a tennis court.
The bravest cut to black in the history of filmmaking.
A lot of the backgrounds to these shots were painted by Dylan Cole, who really cracked the look of the Mordor cloud around Mount Doom and the look of the Black Gates environment.
So wonderful seeing the eagles used in such a beautiful way. We'd had so much early discussion on Gwahir and how the eagles would look, and when we started discussions no one had really done a great CG bird at that time, and to see the final film and see the work that Weta Digital had done with the three eagles was really incredible. Ben Wootton ultimately sculpted the scannable maquette of Gwahir, but Weta Digital went on to develop some procedural techniques for creating the feathers and modelling the bird that I think ultimately rendered the scannable maquette to not a great deal of use as they developed new techniques that we now have picked up on in the workshop and try and utilise.
It's a very fitting climax to many years of work. I know at least seven years work for Peter and 6 years for myself, and so many hours of work that have gone into every aspect of it. I think in the art department we had about 400 people. In a way it was the equivalent of a small Renaissance city. all beavering away at their different crafts.
Yeah, I remember at its height when we had so many workshops working on the various different aspects of the film, you know, like leather workers and drapes.
Metal workers and the
furniture makers
and painters and
foam workshops and things like that, that it had a real energy to it that you don't find in very many other work practices.
Most of those hadn't had any previous experience of working in film at all. I think perhaps 80% of them had come from outside the film industry, just excited by the prospect and the adventure of working on these films. And now they're seasoned professionals. They've had this huge long period of very, very intensive work, and you know, they've done a magnificent job. They're real titans, the guys who made all this stuff.
I like it when all the hobbits jump on the bed. All the others are too mature.
It's kind of a pity in a way that I don't know whether Peter ever was given a tour around the art department facilities, because he never really saw everybody working together. You know, he may have caught glimpses of workshops here and there and people delivering things to see it, but it was really something to see, and it's very heartwarming.
I heard these comments both on the parts of cinema goers and movie critics that the film had multiple endings, and it would end and then not end and end and then not end, as if Peter couldn't decide how to make it end. But I only see one ending. I mean, I only see one ending at the Grey Havens. There's a succession of episodes which sum up the drama, but as long as the homecoming hasn't happened, and then the realization for Frodo that he cannot come home and that there is no home for him, and then finally his leaving Middle-earth, everything is leading up to that. I just could not understand where these comments were really coming from. You know, it didn't seem like multiple endings to me at all, but, and it's also due to the length.
Yeah, because it is truly the end of a trilogy. It's not just, it's really can't be seen too much in isolation as one film. You know, this, it's got such a huge ending.
This is from the backlot, wasn't it?
Yes, we built this set in the backlot for the pickups. And the weather was so bad that we really only got one day.
With all of the armour, the chainmail and the fabric around Aragorn in this scene, Viggo was concerned that he was starting to lose his waistline, and so the poor guy is cinched in around the waist so tightly to try and pull all of these different layers in to create at least some level of form around his waist and hips. So it's surprising he's still standing in moments like this because of the pressure that the armour is putting on him. We wanted the feeling that he is the king of the Numenorean race, not just Gondor, that his royalty and his blood encapsulates all of the history of the lands of Gondor, not just the people as they live in the moment. So rather than the more sophisticated armour that we see on the soldiers and the royal guard around Minas Tirith, we wanted to hark back to the time of the prologue and capture more of the essence of the armour from that period and show that history. A beautiful crown built by Dallas Pohl, one of the jewellery and armoursmiths on the film.
My view of the elves from beginning to end was that no crown on an elf should ever go up. It should always fit the head and go down.
Beautiful headpiece.
Yeah, for sure. That Banos raw silk.
It's always so neat when we see the gelatin ears, as we do in this moment with Liv, where the light's passing through the back of them subtly, showing the translucency of the material, giving them that extra level of reality. Unfortunately, some of the graphite that we had coloured the front of Viggo's armour with had escaped and got down a little tiny crack in the front of the armour, so that when Liv and Viggo came together in this intense embrace, the impact of their bodies puffed this little tiny bit of lost graphite out of the crack, and it actually got onto the fabric of Liv's dress. An over-enthusiastic wardrobe person tried to rub it off, but of course it just increased in diameter, and rightfully so, we befell the wrath of the wardrobe department.
Oh, God. That was just... Yeah, there is only one of those dresses. Yeah, there's a lot of those lead female dresses only exist as a single, as opposed to all those boys' outfits, of which there are many, many, many multiples. But often because these dresses were for just one occasion, there was never really any reason to do any more than one. But also because each one of them took so much work. I mean, they really are couture garments. I mean, that is what they are in a lot of cases. And the thing with the four hobbits was that they had those outfits at the coronation, Frodo and Sam's tatters. And it was only at the very last minute that a decision was made that they should be in sort of revamped versions of their original clothes. And I'm not at all sure whether it ever really made sense in the film, because there was no logic that allowed you to bring their original costumes back to life. So for me, the only way I could actually do that logically was to suggest that the elves gave them, you know, elven versions of their own costumes. Sort of complicated leap there.
They were totally bound by friendship and love.
The map
was ended.
It's basically the same maps that we saw in the previous films. Christian Rivers reworked the area around Minas Tirith, and the map was drawn by Daniel Reeves, who has done most of the maps in the film. And here we are back in Hobbiton. A lovely view of our set.
We didn't actually have time and the opportunity to do a lot of changes, but it was intended for it to have been... not quite as it was when they first left.
Someone likened this moment to me like you would imagine English soldiers returning from the First World War, that none of their family would ever understand what it was truly like.
This is a wonderful scene.
And it was so nice to have that set after doing all that Mordor stuff. It was so lovely to go back into a gentle set where the hobbits could be themselves.
The poignancy of their homecoming is that no one in the Shire really knows what ever happened. These four undisciplined hobbits went away on a trip and came back with rather curious and warlike clothes and weapons, and the Shire is blissfully ignorant of everything that happened. And it makes the depth of the loss that Frodo suffers even greater, because who can he talk to about it? He can talk to Sam, and he can obviously talk to Merry and Pippin, but they've put it all behind them because they're back home.
Reminds me of how I feel when I go back to my little village in Devon. And people just carrying on their normal lives.
They probably wouldn't have noticed you being away.
They haven't even noticed that I've been gone. So this scene was shot in the studio. It was originally intended to be done as an outdoor location, and Peter had picked a spot up on quite close to the studio, overlooking the sea, where we'd shot some of the early Hobbiton stuff. But in the end, it was done in the studio, and I went up to that spot with my digital camera and took some photographs, which we put in the background.
Here we go, back into Bag End.
Which John had designed, probably the first set that he worked on.
I really had lots of fun designing Bag End. I tried to design Bag End as a place that I would live in if I could. And to make it comfortable, but a bit aristocratic and a bit luxurious, but nonetheless very, very earthy and
It's the example that I always brandish in the face of everybody who tells me, well, you did all the dark stuff in Middle-earth. You know, you did all the evil, creepy, spiky stuff. I said, well, no. You know, I designed a fairly welcoming little hobbit hole and other things. So, you know, it's nice to have had the opportunity to have such a variety of things to design in a movie like that. You know, such a vast palette of architecture to work with.
The handwriting of Daniel Reeve, who not only did most of the maps, but did a lot of work in the three main books we see in these films. There's Bilbo's book, and there's the book in the Mines of Moria, and Saruman's book, which we see in the Two Towers.
The idea with the two weapons on the wall is just like war trophies. We like the idea that Frodo has decided to carry on and bring treasures back to the Shire and back to Bag End. And there's a little crest on the wall now of memories of battles long gone.
Now, I seriously, if I ever could, I would love a house like Bag End. Probably not buried in a hillside, because it, you know, it's tough to get enough windows in a place like that. But architecturally, it was very much a place I wouldn't mind living in.
That's the cart for the Grey Havens. It doesn't
turn very well.
Goes in straight lines really well. But because it was the sort of medieval design we were after, which was where the front wheels, they can't turn underneath the cart, which is normal practice in a wagon. So you only get a little bit of play. So you need quite a lot of road to turn it around on.
Because of the late arrival of Sir Ian Holm to New Zealand, we only got his head cast a week or so before he was needed on set. So it was a very rushed effort to sculpt the prosthetics done so beautifully by Michael Asquith. Unfortunately, the night before the scene was due, we got information that it was preferred that we didn't use the prosthetics, and in fact it was done as a stretch and stipple technique with a bald cap and hair pieces. It was very, very disappointing for us. But on the morning, very thankfully, Sir Ian Holm saw it sitting on his head cast in the corner of the makeup bus and asked what on earth it was. We said it was his prosthetics, but we'd been told that he wasn't keen on wearing it. He said that wasn't at all the case, said to immediately start gluing it on. So we have an awful lot to thank Ian for in regards to this makeup.
Well, here's a sight I have never seen before.
So the Grey Havens. We look out over the miniature set with the miniature elven boat in the foreground.
Of anywhere in Middle-earth, I think this is the place I'd most love to live. We'd built 14th scale sections of the Grey Havens many years earlier, but when we came to do the pickups for film 3 once again, Peter gave us the opportunity to expand the miniature, and at 35th and 72nd scale, we got to build the whole of the harbour of the Grey Havens and worked on the architecture and the landforms, working from a series of Alan Lee sketches.
Didn't seem appropriate to have the same type of elvish architecture that we see at Rivendell at the Grey Havens, because you'd expect more stonework in a location that's right next to the sea. And it's meant to feel like a more ancient elvish city.
This is after the exodus of elves, so you would imagine there would have been a lot of them travelling out of here at some stage, and this is really just the tail end of it.
Yeah, and they were a huge presence in Middle-earth. There were many elven cities, and we wanted to give them a substantial port as well.
This was a really delightful miniature to build, and you can truly imagine living in these incredible buildings up on the cliffs and spending the hours whiling away along the water's edge. We've actually built this boat at third scale in a seaworthy state, with the idea that hopefully one day, when we gain permission from New Line, we might be able to sail it across the Wellington Harbour. So we look forward to that day. Hopefully you won't all read a headline about how the whole of the Weta crew has drowned trying to sail a Grey Haven ship. Alan would come down to the workshop, as he so often would with the miniatures, and come and do little bits of paint detail and so on. You can't see it in these shots, but there's actually even woodworm detail in the handrails and the uprights. There's incredibly fine gilding around certain details, and individual steamed planking down the sides of the boat. How do elves steer a ship? How do they rig the sails? We wanted to come up with a slightly different rig than what we've seen in our own world. And John Baster worked out a wonderful rig and a wonderful cut to the sails that could practically work. The on-set crew did an expert job dressing the decks with all of the provisions and supplies needed for this long journey.
Seeing these scenes on film makes it feel complete.
It's like you come the full circle when you sit back and watch the movie. Is in a very similar state you're in when you first read the script, because you're conjuring up all these images in your mind and kicking around how the film's going to look. And you know, it's those very early times actually have resonance at the very end to me, because actually seeing the results of that sort of early conceptual work, having gone through all the mechanical sort of process of making it happen, you get to see it again as a piece of art. You know, you sort of you come the full circle.
It's going to be very interesting to see how it develops over the years. You know, I feel that these are classic films and they're going to be around for a very long time. And I've always felt that books and films are such distinctly different experiences that you don't really carry over images from one into another. They're very separate things. But I'm finding that when I do pick up the book again and imagine Gandalf, it is Ian McKellen's face that pops up.
The images have been so sort of pervasive, really, and just the whole success of the project relates it very strongly back to the book. But I think, you know, in even more time, people will get to see the book in its own original light again, and perhaps one day someone might make a new version of it. Who knows?
How many times have you sat and watched the Oscars and thought, wow, that's great, those people were so much ahead of the class, they're at the peak of their sort of career, etc., 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 and suddenly we're in that box, you know, it's astounding. And you can't go back from that, and you can't really do a hell of a lot better, you know. Hopefully you just stay there for a while.
God, it was so great to see those guys on that stage. I mean, if anyone truly deserved to walk away with Oscars that night, it was the art direction, production design team. I think that was probably the most important thing about that evening for me, was that group.
It's bittersweet, you know. It's kind of amazing to have done it and to have achieved so much in the last 5 years, but it's also a little bit sad that we won't see all those people again.
But it's interesting too, because you know, there's still those people who become part of your life, and no matter what, when you see them again, no matter how long it is, you go back to the sort of relationship you had with any friend, you know, with any person that you got to know really well and got to like, you know.
Sitting with my partner Tanya and my family at the premiere of Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, seeing these final moments and reflecting on the years of our lives that we've spent on these films, and being comfortable finally reaching the end and knowing that there wasn't one moment of wasted time, there wasn't one moment when we would rather have been doing something else. It was hard at times, but never so hard that we wouldn't have wanted to do it.
That it can come to an end, this sort of marathon, this sort of road movie, this journey trip that everybody, I think, involved in the movie ended up taking, I think is good, because it's there and back again, you know. There's no point in going there if you don't go back. And that you can say exactly what Sam says in the last scene as well: I'm back. And wasn't it a great trip? But isn't it good to be back? And isn't it going to be good to set out again and do something else?
I'm back.
A lot of people have asked me, well, what are you going to work on after working on something like Lord of the Rings? And I say, well, I don't know. Circumstance will dictate that. And well, how are you going to compare working on another movie, if you ever do, to working on something like Lord of the Rings? And I think there's no point in comparing. You know, we're not trying to establish a hierarchy of what you do in your life. You know, life is about something else. And I'm glad it's done. You know, I really am content. And I'm very, very glad for everyone that was involved in it, because it was such a huge, impossible task. So, you know, hats off and a round of applause, and see what else is in store.
You really have to go back to the fact that it all stems from Peter being so brilliant.
It all just comes from the top, doesn't it? The trickle-down effect.
Oh, yeah.
It's his inspiration that spurred everybody on and made them raise their sights on what was possible and what they could achieve.
He certainly has such a great grasp of the whole process that goes beyond any one sort of technician, because he understands the whole process, not just his part of it.
Peter is such a unique filmmaker as well. He has a very distinctive style, and you can't really tie it into any particular period. I think maybe the effects are going to be the thing which does date it in the end. You'll know that it couldn't have been made before a certain period. But I think Peter's style of storytelling is very distinctive, and it doesn't really fit into typical Hollywood pattern.
Peter's always said he's making a film for the fans, which does not mean he's doing opinion polls on the net and stuff like that and trying to find out what people want to see. Because when he's saying, I'm doing a film for the fans, that means that he is giving up his own personality and his own pretensions in the face of a creative project where he has to disappear into it. You can see touches of Peter throughout the film, you know, constantly. But this is kind of a reflection of the effervescence he has as a personality. It's not a calculated effort to imprint on a film his mark, you know, so people will be continually reminded this is definitely a Peter Jackson film, and this is definitely his take on something. I really believe it's a totally intuitive thing, and if he is sufficiently in touch with what makes Tolkien worthwhile to read, then he can only produce a film which will be appreciated by the fans.
So this was my last contribution to the film, just as we were doing the last few effect shots. Peter and Fran came up with the idea of doing something a little bit different for the credits, which was to add in drawings. So I did drawings of the actors, especially for it, and then they used some of the drawings from my sketchbooks and some of John's as well for these shots.
Having started out on this trip back in January 1998, and to actually come ultimately out of it in the end of 2004, when the final DVD will be released, is quite a hike. And although I wasn't involved in more than the pre-production, there still is the anticipation of waiting for the movies to come out and the reactions of people and the revealing of these films to the audience worldwide. I really feel very, very happy now that that it's made that full journey without stumbling and without going astray.
I think I was in a fairly privileged position in a way, because Grant's responsible for the production design, for the overall look of the movie, and I'm kind of irresponsible for the look of the movie in a way. I have sort of a freer hand, and no one's going to give me a hard time if I've drawn something that's more elaborate than... mind you, actually, some people did give me a hard time.
Really, the premieres were when it was over, weren't they?
Mm.
And so it was a big celebration and a big party.
It went on for 2 weeks.
It just went on and on. And at the end of it, we flew home and it was over, you know. And
It's kind of...
It wasn't quite the sense of relief that you usually have when a film's over, because it's, you know, you put everything into it and you're exhausted and you just step off the end and you go, oh, thank God, you know, get on the road and drive home. Whereas this has sort of had its finishes and part finishes and started up again. And so it's, for me, really, it I don't really believe that it's over yet.
No, I think everyone's lived a Lord of the Rings lifetime in the interim, haven't we? All through the films.
Everyone was inspired by the books. Everyone read the books. And it was a labour of love.
Yeah, I think they all knew they were working on something pretty special at the time.
Yeah. Every farewell, there were tears, you know. It was really sad. It's really sad to finally say goodbye.
The last 6.5 years have truly been one of the most enjoyable periods of our lives that we could have ever have hoped for, and to ultimately have played a small part in the creation of such a beautiful work of art, a work of art that's been crafted by a director, by a film crew, by a cast of amazing actors, but more importantly by a whole nation of people, by the people of New Zealand, is a great thing to have been part of.
It's funny how it just became our life. It was our life for 5 years.
Oh yeah.
There was no other life.
It was one of the great things about working together as partners in a department, when the demands are so extreme that, and you put in such huge hours, that you have a sort of understanding of each other and what your partner's going through and been through, and you don't have to ask those questions about how come you worked all night last night, you know, because you know.
And also we seem to balance each other too. When Dan was feeling exhausted or depressed about something, I would feel okay, and so I'd jolly him through it, and then vice versa, so it works in that way as well.
And it was not just between us, it was the whole department, and then beyond that the whole film, you know, that everyone could see at various times that other people were struggling, and there was a support there which was great.
And nobody wanted to let anyone else down, you know, so everybody was very happy to go the extra yards and work overnight or stay late and you know, do something again for the third, fourth, fifth time to get it right. So you know, and it was kind of competitive in that way, in a sense as well. You know, people would be really thrilled when someone turns up with an object that had been made that nobody else had known about, and they all kind of oohed and aahed about things, and then went back into their own corners and did their own work, you know.
Honestly, I surrounded myself with these people who were funny, hard-working, clever, never-say-die types. Therein lies the joy of, you know, when it... And it's one of those things where I could probably talk for hours about the heartbreak and the tears, but what you can also talk about is the people who let you run with these ideas. If resistance existed anywhere, I think it would be like a house of cards. I mean, it would collapse. But somehow, nobody really resisted. You know, so many sort of spectacular results happened because of it.
Over half of our working careers have been spent making the three films of Lord of the Rings. Over the half of the period of time that we've known Peter Jackson and his family, our son was born on this film. Marriages were formed at Weta Workshop on this film. Children were born, mortgages were bought into, and an incredible period of history have passed through our company. But in amongst all of that has been the ongoing enjoyment and knowledge that we were working on something that has been thoroughly satisfying, that we had been gifted with the opportunity to bring Tolkien's written literature to the screen. And seeing the final moments of this film, I can rest assured that everyone involved put their greatest efforts into doing the best job they possibly could.
Well, thank you for allowing us to share this with you. It's the end of an extraordinary journey for myself and everyone else who's worked on these projects. And again, I'd just like to reiterate that whatever we've done has been as part of a huge collective endeavour, and everyone who's been involved with the art department should be really, really proud of what they've been doing. And so I hope you've enjoyed it too, and goodbye.
The same. I'd like to wish everybody well, and that they've sat through a lot of movie making here, and I think it's testament really that the time can fly when you watch these movies, you know, or even though you might have been sitting here for 4 hours, it often doesn't feel that way. But thanks to the indefatigable efforts of the art department crew and all the rest of the crew at large, and the actors who made our work look so good, and to Alan and John, who conjured up this world that I think is going to live with people for a long time.
This is Dan Henner. I'll say it again, that sounds really weird. Yes, this is Dan Henner emotionally saying goodbye from The Return of the King. Thanks.
I'm just going to laugh now. This is Chris Henner saying goodbye from Middle Earth. Maybe we'll go back one day. Who knows?
This is Richard Taylor sitting here with my partner Tanya. I'd just love to thank you all for watching. Oh, and please write in and insist that we all get to make The Hobbit. Cheers for now. We'll see you later. Bye.